Again, the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. This podcast is for Monday, January 14th, 2013, and it's podcast number 259. My name is Ben Stone, and with me today on the podcast is a very special guest, Ademo Freeman. Ademo, welcome to Bad Quaker Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Like we had talked about just before the show started, our paths seem to have been very close and crossing, yet this is the first time we've actually communicated with one another.
Yeah, we were kind of walking past each other regularly as we were both involved in all kinds of different activities at Pork Fest, and we've passed each other, probably passed each other on the highway before, as a matter of fact. But Ademo, you and Pete founded Cop Block. That's at copblock.org. And I just want to read the a statement from Cop Block so that there's no misunderstanding about what we're talking about here. Cop Block is a decentralized project supported by a diverse group of individuals united by their shared goal of police accountability. So it's easy to say what Cop Block is in that statement. What Cop Block is not is an excuse to just beat up on cops and pick on cops and so forth. Am I right there?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I mean, copblock.org is a decentralized project, which is like the second most important aspect to it, I feel. And the decentralization is why there's been so many groups, why we get so many traffic, why our Facebook page has almost 40,000 likes. And, you know, it also allows the conversation to be very diverse. You get some folks who come in there and say, you know, citizen review boards or this type of on the ground interaction with police officers is best. But what it really creates is a well-rounded, well-documented conversation about the issues of policing today. And that happens now at the one hub, one-stop shop of copblock.org.
And we're not talking about a, you know, an anarchist organization or a libertarian organization or a right wing or a left wing or a Republican or a Democrat. This is really not that. This is really a decentralized project, right?
Exactly. I mean, we strive for it to be our best. Now, a lot of people give me grief or Pete and say, well, you have control of the website or you have access or limited access to a Facebook page. Like, of course, like the decentralization is the idea. The ideas are a bulletproof and the ideas are free for anyone to use in whatever manner. You know, there have been over 60 groups, and folks who are interested in finding one can go to copblock.org/group. But all over the country and through all that spontaneous, you know, order, folks have erected voluntary structures. You know, some work with some individuals promote this idea of police accountability, some work with this other. You know, I can't speak for all the copblock.org websites out there, but I can speak for copblock.org, the website. And I can say that if you use copblock.org/submit to share your story, all we're going to do is edit it to, you know, be grammatically and structurally correct, maybe add a picture so that it's visually appealing on the website and share it. You know, there have been times where somebody's advocated some sort of tactic to police accountability that I don't necessarily agree with, but I don't censor it from the website, at least the websites of copblock.org that I have access to and creative undertaking at. But I am the first person to comment and say, yeah, I really appreciate this guy taking the time to do this, but I don't know if this is the most effective, or actually I believe this instead. And there you get viewpoint A and viewpoint B, and then the readers can sit there and decipher which is the best tactic, or in probably most cases they probably blend both and make something even better.
And you guys have taken some hate, specifically by, you know, pro-law enforcement organizations that I think is a little bit unnecessary, because really, you know, for me personally, people who have heard my series on that I did on the inevitability of the police state and so forth, my listeners know that my position is that anytime that you take one segment of the population and you give them extra rights that nobody else has, and then you expect them not to be negatively impacted by that, and you know, you expect a good result from that happening, you're making a mistake. And that's what we've done with police, you know, since the late 1700s when they were first invented in England. But above and beyond my opinion on that, really, even if you support law enforcement and you think it's a good idea to have police and so forth, an organization like CopBlock can be a useful tool even for law enforcement if they will take advantage of it.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Ayer, the co-founder of CopBlock.org, made a great page called Welcome Leos, and that's CopBlock.org/WelcomeLeos. And it's a great page, and it's getting a lot of traffic at our site. And we know that, I mean, I don't have exact numbers, and do I know because I don't look at them that closely, but I probably could figure it out. But I do believe that a lot of our 100,000 unique views every month or more are a good portion of either current or former Leos, and that's law enforcement officer. And so I do think that, you know, the overall message of highlighting some of these interactions with police and having this discussion is hope, you know, to me, the goal would be to reach them, because I feel law enforcement, which is, this is kind of an underlining issue of why I founded CopBlock.org to begin with, but enforcers, the law enforcement aspect of this society, of this government, is where the rubber meets the road. You know, I could focus a very long time, and people actually have, on the political foundations of those who write laws and try to control or regulate society. And in my opinion, they haven't been very successful over the 200 plus years this government has been enacted. And so if we would then focus maybe where the rubber meets the road on the law enforcers, then it doesn't matter what people in your state capital or Washington, D.C. write on paper, because there's no one to enforce it. And so that's why I feel that CopBlock.org is A, effective, and B, important. So, you know, not to take anything from people who try the political route. Like, I'm not one of these, you know, libertarian, anarchist, voluntarist, whatever label you want to give me, I fit under them all. But I'm not one of them who really spends a lot of time saying you're doing this right or you're doing that wrong. I'm doing my thing, and I believe in what I'm doing. And as long as somebody is doing that as well, then great. I hope to see you on the beach, on the road to liberty, you know, a voluntary society. It's fine by me.
Yeah, and on that same tone, I should point out that, you know, you and I and Pete and I mean, we could name anybody else like that that's in the movement as a whole. We don't necessarily have to agree on everything that each other is doing to still be able to work together. One of the great things about CopBlock is its decentralization. You could, I mean, it, in the condition that it's in right now, let's just have a horrible worst-case scenario. Let's say a meteor falls from the sky and lands on your head as we finish this conversation. I hope that doesn't happen, but if it did, the way CopBlock is set up, it would continue even if you were taken out of the picture completely. And that's really something that everybody in the liberty movement can learn from.
Sure. I guess I could also answer a few comments that you made earlier with the same reference. You know, CopBlock.org, you know, and I keep emphasizing the one website because there's Ohio CopBlock, there's the Carolinas CopBlock, there's Mass CopBlock, there's all these other websites that have CopBlock in it. So, and so the diversity is showing. So like, there's like a Georgia CopBlock that's like an LLC. There's our CopBlock that is, you know, more decentralized. And so these show the wide ranges of abilities and stuff. And so though you said before, CopBlock isn't particularly libertarian, anarchist, whatever, each chapter does kind of have its own feel. You know, CopBlock.org has a good base. Don't get me wrong, there's plenty of people who contribute, but there is a good base of people here that are constantly active that would probably describe themselves as voluntarist. And due to that, you know, we do pop up on like most popular libertarian website polls and stuff like that. And so I appreciate it. But another thing to solidify the point you just made, 2012 was a hard year for me. I tried a different business option, working in silver, that wasn't very successful, which took my time away from CopBlock.org. And then I spent 92 days in a house of corrections, which is was nothing like a place that corrects any behavior. But and CopLock, yeah, still functioned, went along, booming on just well. And again, it's all because of the decentralization. So just because one person goes away doesn't mean CopLock.org is going to stop. It is definitely a machine. I don't like to use the term beast, but it is a machine of its own.
Would you be interested in explaining how it was that you became a guest of the state and why some people in New Hampshire chose to keep you there against your will?
Sure. I mean, it's kind of a long story, and folks should head over to coplock.org/freeademo to get a better understanding. And that is a meta post that pretty much is every single blog, video, government documentation I've ever gotten. Compiled by myself and later Pete Ayer because I was incarcerated. And so 2011, June, I was arrested for graffiti, criminal mischief, and resisting arrest for chalking a police station in Manchester, New Hampshire. Fast forward a couple months to October, and Pete and I are in Manchester, New Hampshire to highlight our cases. Not only ours, but the other 6-7 people that were arrested at that protest as well. And the Chalking 8 arrest, is what we call that, is due to 4 Manchester police officers who were off duty beat a guy so bad that he had lost some feeling on the left side of his face and as well as most of the teeth on his upper jaw. And this is merely 4 cops who walked out of a bar and interjected themselves into an incident with a bar owner and a patron. The patron felt he was being wrongfully asked to leave the property. And though he was fine and outside and said, okay, I'm out of here, but please go tell my friends. And while they were waiting for that, these 4 cops stumbled by and said, what are you doing? And the man, Chris is his name, got a little lippy with him and said, mind your business. And when he said that, they immediately pounced on him and beat him badly. And they were in street clothes. He didn't know that they were cops. And then, so when the cops came, actually, they take Chris to the hospital. And they tell all 4 officers, no big deal, go home. You know, don't worry about it. You know, if that had been anybody else, you go down to the police station, you probably have to make bail, or you spend the night in Valley Street until Valley Street is the county jail, until you see a judge. And so none of those things happened. So we held a protest saying, hey, badges don't grant extra rights. This is the tagline of coplock.org. You know, if you guys are here to swear and protect the society, then you know, you should do your job. Or at least that's what you say you do, and basically just to point out the hypocrisy and the set of rules for them and the set of rules for us. So I was arrested during that, and like I said, fast forward a couple months, and we're in Manchester to highlight the trials of the Chalking Ape. And we're running around town, you know, handing out flyers, DVDs, coplock.org stickers, and interacting with the community. We're chalking the sidewalks because they actually stopped arresting people for using children's chalk. I think they realized that it was kind of ridiculous. But during that time, we met 2 high school students, Frank Harrington and Michael Prox. I always mess up his last name. But they took a liking to coplock.org, and they actually have had experience with police, even though they were 16 and 17 years old, about hanging out in parks, you know, and, you know, going home and you know, like just minor stuff for no good reason other than the cop probably telling them what to do. And so it just so happened 2 or 3 weeks after interacting with myself and Pete, Frank had an interaction with the police officer at his school, and the police officer, the Manchester police officer, again, this is New Hampshire, and had come up to him, Frank, at lunch with the assistant principal, and they were inquiring about a pink purse that Frank had. And of course, Frank being a 17-year-old boy, it was a little awkward for him to have a pink purse. And he said he took it from his sister, and they said, well, did your sister know it? And he's like, no, I'm kind of messing with her. And mind you, his sister is sitting at the lunch table behind him. And so they asked the sister. It seems to be like a sibling dispute over some candy and something that happened at home. And so the principal hands the bag, the pink bag, back to the sister. And you can see this in the video. But then he comes back and says to Frank, well, now you're suspended. You know, grab your tray and come to my office. You're going to be going home. And Frank then says, why the F am I suspended? And at that moment, when he says the F word, the officer grabs him by the hair, lifts him up out of his feet are dangling, lifts him off the ground, slams him on the table. As he bounces off, he hooks his arms around his back and spins and slams him to another table and ultimately onto the ground, where he puts his knee in his back and handcuffs him, for disorderly conduct. The students, Frank and Michael, took this video to the local news station, WMUR, who for one whole day didn't do anything with it, never aired it, never talked about it. It was never an issue. Then the students found myself. I shot a short interview with them, put the video online, and just before making it public, I decided to call the Manchester Police Department as well as the school, all the public officials, to get comment. And so, because in my opinion, it seemed that the public officials were trying to sweep this under the rug, because the principal is heard on the video stating that it is illegal to film public officials, that they must delete it, and that if they don't delete it, they're going to be expelled. And so Mike actually tricked the principal, deleted a picture, a thumbnail that was generated by the video, and kept the video. So when I called and inquired about the incident, both people, both parties that I spoke to, the officer and the principal, said I, you know, defiantly told me that I did not know what I was talking about, that the kid was being disorderly, that he was being aggressive, and that he had committed theft. And I said, well, actually, I'm not so much concerned about the bag because that was given back in the video. And I said, yeah, just so you know, I've seen the video. And at that moment, everybody clams up and or hangs up on me and they don't want to talk anymore. Due to the video and the interview that I had being released, it ended up going viral, the video that Michael took it inside the school. And many media people from Washington, D.C., all the way up the East Coast, came to New Hampshire to investigate. And so the police were forced to open an internal investigation. About 6 months later, after the media died down, the police released the findings of their internal investigation. They were clear that they were looking at six people, the officer, the principal's secretary, and the principal, so three public officials. And then they were looking at three other individuals, myself, Michael, and Frank, for any wrongdoing. The conclusion of their internal investigation was that the officer, the secretary, and the principal didn't do anything wrong and actually acted with great regards to their public capacity. And then they expelled Frank Harrington from the school. They charged Mike, who about 2 weeks after recording this incident got into a fight over a girl like most men do when they're teenagers. He didn't cause any extensive damage like the four police officers did to Chris about a year earlier. But he got into a fight and the police charged him with felony aggravated assaults and trumped up charges, in my opinion. Essentially, you know, they put him in jail at a very young age. And then myself was charged with three counts of felony wiretapping for three phone calls I made to three public individuals and threatened to incarcerate me for 10 and a half to 21 years in prison. So that's, and the way I found out about these charges was through the newspaper, because the police never called me in, never did any other investigation and anything. So I was charged, or actually indicted, and then everything goes on, stalls out. My chalking charges, which I was actually convicted of and sentenced to a year in jail, 10 months suspended, 2 months had to be served now. I was actually appealing that at the moment. And that case had like went silent. Nobody had told me about a trial date for my appeal because I wanted a jury trial. I only had a judge trial. Well, about 2 months before my wiretapping charge trial, I get a letter in the mail saying I missed my chalking 8 trial. And this is just impossible because I haven't moved. I haven't changed any addresses. I've never missed a court date. I was actually asking for a jury trial. And so I went to do some investigation before my court hearing on why I missed it. And I come to find out that the city of Manchester mailed my jury trial date letter to an address that doesn't even exist. Not only did they do that, but I could prove that they did it and that it was a clerical error. The letter was returned to the court and placed in my case file for some reason. I believe this to be a mistake, but it was done so anyways. And so I was able to get the copy of the letter and photograph it. And then I was able to get the envelope and photograph it. And the envelope bore an address that does not exist, but the letter inside the envelope had my correct heading, my name, address, and everything on it. And so normally when you would fold that letter up and stick it in an envelope, the envelope would have a pre-made window, a clear box for the address, but for some reason, this letter was put into a regular envelope with no clear box, and an address was added with a sticker. So in my opinion, and some people might think I'm getting a little wacko on this, but it was decided that if I'm going to be facing felony wiretapping charges, what better place for me to be than the Hillsborough County Correctional Facility during that time, because it would be very difficult and stressful for me to prepare for a wiretapping case or any trial from the inside of a jail. And so I filed a motion saying, hey, this is what happened. This is your fault. I've never missed a trial. Do, you know, help me out. And two judges both said, nope, we have no obligation to actually tell you or make sure you are notified of your trial. In fact, we blame you for not being here when you didn't know you were supposed to be here, and you're going to go to jail. So I was sent to jail on July 11th, about a month before my wiretapping trial, due to the state's mistake.
When we, I'm going to save this file. When we come back from the commercial break, we're going to pick back up on this and talk about some of the obvious flaws that took place in this. So stick with us through the commercial. We'll be right back with the Demo Freeman.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com. Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics. There are video and audio files you can download, you can participate in the discussion boards, and there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators. Join Tom and his team and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge. And you can get all this for just $99 a year. Go to badquaker.com, click on the banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, and by using this link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with me through the break. This is Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast, and with me is Ademo Freeman. Before the break, we were talking about your your fun and games up there in Manchester in New Hampshire. And some of the obvious things that a person might be struck by this story is that keep in mind when you're talking about chalking, just for the listener's sake, we are talking about taking a piece of chalk and writing on either a sidewalk or like a, you know, sometimes a bench or sometimes the wall of a building or whatever. We're not talking about any permanent damage of any kind, the first rainstorm and it all disappears. So we're not talking about damage. We're not talking about taking the chalk and throwing it at somebody or something like that. There's no actual property damage taking place. It's just basically expressing an opinion with chalk, right?
Exactly. And we're also just talking about public property. The Manchester police station has a huge retainer wall, and for those who know what a retainer wall is, it holds back a large amount of dirt or soil. Commonly there are plants or something in it, like there are in Manchester. There's a bunch of bushes that are raised higher up as the building has a multi-level facade from the outside. And so, you know, we're talking about a public building, b children's chalk, and c on concrete, which again, like you mentioned, there was no damage. For my chalking 8 trial, they assessed the damage at $375 for the chalking. And mind you, there was 40 people outside chalking. The police were only able to arrest 9. And so I made the point in my trial that, okay, where'd this $375 come from? Well, an officer testified that the police department was called out and they billed, the fire department was called out and they billed the police department $375, and he produced this bill. Well, this bill said it took like 175 gallons of water to wash this stuff off, and it took them about 50 minutes. But they have a minimum charge of 3 hours at $125 an hour, so they charge 3 hours of work for 50 minutes of work, and that's where $375 came up at. And so my conclusion of my chalking charge was that I was fined $1,200 for criminal mischief, and then I was sentenced to 1 year in jail for disorderly conduct, also known as resisting arrest. And
because I went limp when they arrested me, because I felt that my actions were freedom of speech protected and also didn't damage anybody's property. So I went limp. And so I tried to make the point to the judges, you just fined me three times the amount of damage that was caused, and you're going to lock me up in jail. I don't even see how this is justice at all. You know, nobody asked me to clean up the chalk. Nope. You know, I might have been willing to do so. Instead, they just used force against me. And so it just goes to show the system on how it's not really about making a victim whole. You know, they call it the justice system, and justice to me is, you know, people are not perfect, and I am absolutely not perfect. And if I ever make a mistake, which happens, I want to make, you know, if my mistake affects another person that has harmed them in some way of loss, then I want to make them right. And, you know, I've had to do this in my life, I'm sure, as we all have. But that wasn't the case here. You know, $375 was first an overestimation of what the actual damage, if any damage, was actually caused. And then I was charged three times that amount and sentenced to jail. I don't see how this was keeping society safe.
And then when we consider the actions of the cop with the teenage kid in a lunchroom in a school where I've seen the video, like a lot of people have, where a fairly large, strong cop grabs basically a little kid. I mean, you know, 15, 16, 17. I was bigger than most of the kids in my school at that age, but I was still, you know, a little kid at that age. And so this big cop grabs this little guy and just slams him face first into the desk. And then they essentially lie about it when they tell the other kid who was filming that he's not allowed to do that. When the law is just the opposite. So, I mean, they're just making up the law as they go along and making it be whatever it is they want it to be. And then one of the other things, this idea of wiretapping, you know, they put laws in about wiretapping specifically to control the government so that the government couldn't spy on us as citizens. And then over the years, this idea of wiretapping now means that if a member of the media, which is what you are, calls a public official on a public, a publicly paid for telephone line to question them about a public case that's happening, and that person is on duty at the time being paid by the government, somehow one of the school people made the argument that they weren't actually a public official or something like that, right?
The principal tried to say in court that she was not a public official, and then I completely nullified her statement by saying, well, who pays you? And she said, well, the city of Manchester pays me. And I'm like, well, what is the city of Manchester? You know,
are they really? Now, I'll ask you, this is just strictly opinion, and it doesn't represent Cop Block, and it doesn't represent any particular organization. But do you think they're really that dumb that they believe things like that when they say them? Because, you know, that's a pretty stupid statement, really.
Sadly, I feel she did. I got, you know, I'm looking her in the face when I asked her these questions. And, you know, you can tell when you've asked the question where the wheels start turning. And, you know, I think she immediately realized the hypocrisy of her statement. And, you know, I do feel that some public officials don't really view themselves as that. You know, I've gotten that experience from, you know, like a parks and recreations guy who will come up to you and say something about, you know, public officials. And you're like, well, you're a public official. He's like, no, I'm not. And you're like, you know, there are some tasks that seem so far removed from the actual, you know, government. You know, they don't think if they're not like spending budget or if they're not like enforcing ordinance or law, then they're not public official, you know. But the public official title goes all the way down to the janitor who's cleaning the mayor's toilets, you know, everything. You know, if your city has trash collection that is done and paid for through taxation, then your garbage collectors are public officials, you know. And so sometimes you believe that that's the beauty of the institution, is removing people so many steps from the actual harm that the areas and the visions get grayed, you know.
There's another thing that I've seen, especially in, you know, there's been so many things recorded up in New Hampshire with the different activities going on with the Free State Project. And there's this fallacy that I've seen on several recordings where, you know, like school officials are standing on public school property trying to say that this is private property, you can't pass out this literature, or this is private property, you can't record, or, you know, and you're like, this person saying this is a high school principal making the argument that school property is private property. Now, I hate to be rude, but how stupid can a person be? That is just so blatantly ignorant to me that I don't know how an educated person who is in charge of educating children can be dumb enough to make that kind of an argument.
Yeah, it'll surprise you. And then if you could start breaking it down to them, which we've done over sometimes or some experiences, and that's where you're like, so, you know, this is public property. Like, all right, well, you don't have a permission to hand this stuff out. And then it's like, whoa, this is an institution of learning, isn't it? And I didn't know things are like pre-required or people don't, you know, you remove the voluntary aspect of just being able to accept some information from another individual. Like, our students are allowed, you know, where does this line of censorship stop? You know, are the students told that they can communicate with one another about ideas or lessons or, you know what I mean? Or is it just the usual, you know, institution of learning that the public schools has become, which is, you know, I teach, you regurgitate, we move on, you know? And so it's if folks would look at it with an open mind and a level of clarity, you know, yes, the things you mentioned about these guys saying that they A, aren't public officials, and B, this isn't public property, but go even further and say, wow, if they're stopping a business card or a small flyer being handed out, what are they doing on the inside, or how is the classroom actually going? And, you know, that's one thing that, you know, so many things were done well with the Free a Damo campaign and my wiretapping trial. But one thing that disappointed me a lot was the lack of support I received from the parents of the students of that school. I mean, the Manchester government headhunted me, from the city members to the DAs to the judges to the police department, and including the school, on this case. Not only did they charge me with felonies when I should have been charged with misdemeanors at best and nothing at all because I was a member of the press, but the school bans copblock.org from being viewed on its computers, put an IT block on it. They banned any materials, the DVDs, the business cards, the flyers, the informational stuff about what was happening directly there in Manchester, as well as the clothing that a lot of high school students started purchasing through copblock.org/store. You would get suspended for the rest of the day or have to go home and change if you wore a copblock.org shirt to school. And so this is flat out censorship, you know? And so where were the parents? Like, wherever, forget if they don't actually support copblock.org's mission. Do they support censorship of a school, you know, in a school?
It would be interesting also to go into the same school's library and see if they have a copy of Mein Kampf, or if they have a copy of, some Marxist writings or whatever, because I'll bet they're in there. You know, they're probably perfectly comfortable with that stuff being in there, but not something that shines the light on what they're doing.
Exactly. And, you know, aside from that aspect that I just touched on, to show more of how this is a headhunt, like I had mentioned just before the break, I was put in jail for a reason that wasn't my fault at all. It was totally, at the least, a clerical error, at the most, a flat-out conspiracy to cage me before being put on trial for 2 decades of my life. You know, I mean, what was going on here? You know, this is a total case of headhunting, and it was proven at my sentencing for the wiretapping, which I was found guilty of. After refusing a plea deal of us, that I could have just walked out of jail. My trial was on a Monday. That Friday I was supposed to be released due to my chalking sentence. I was done serving my time for that. And at my trial, when I was found guilty, I could have said, sentence me later, and I could have walked out of there on Friday. Or just before my trial, I could have taken a plea deal of a 1-year suspended sentence, but I would have had to admit that the actions I did were in fact illegal, and that was something I could not bring myself to do. I thought about it because I was in jail and I really wanted to get out, but at the end of the day, I just couldn't bring myself to admit wrongdoing when something that I felt was absolutely right.
It's a strange thing. You know, I've seen this throughout the Liberty Movement and all its different aspects for years and years now, is our almost to a man and woman, I should say, is our strict adherence to the truth and our love of the truth. And even when we have the opportunity to help ourselves. And this is not, I guess this is not always, because I could name some people who decided to rat out their friends and take a plea and so forth. But I would say the vast majority of people in the liberty movement have such an affection to the truth that they really have a hard time folding under and accepting the lies that are given to us by the government, even when it's to their best interest.
Yeah, I understand. Plea deals, interactions with the states, these things are so subjective due to, like, you know, I don't have a wife, I don't have any kids, and so it's probably a lot easier for me to say, you know, F you, man, and let's do this. So I don't condemn anybody who does things. A good friend of mine, Derek J. Freeman, who has a great video documentary movie out there called Derek's Victimless Crime Spree. And, you know, he ended up taking a plea deal at the end of that. And I don't think it's, you know, it's subjective. It was the right thing for him to do and weighing all his decisions. So I can understand why people do it. Me personally, I have a hard time saying to the man, yeah, I did wrong, when, you know, I've been arrested probably 20 times since I become a full-time activist, and never, ever has there ever been a victim, B, any violence, or C, anyone who claims that I have cost them a loss of either their, you know, personal well-being or property.
Yeah, I should mention that I wasn't, when I was talking about somebody that was ratting people out, I wasn't talking about Derek there. I agree with his choice in that situation. I probably would have played some of the early situations different than he did, but as it worked out, I think he's in pretty good situation. I wouldn't want to be he's basically banned from being in New Hampshire for a year or something like that, isn't he?
Well, he's done essentially what I've done as well. I mean, the conclusion of my wiretapping was, mind you, I was facing 10 and a half to 21 years in prison. I was found guilty of all three charges, so per the law, I should be in prison right now, doing at least 10 and a half years. But the judge, who was somewhat sympathetic, in my opinion, throughout my trial, he didn't even sentence me to the minimum per the law, and then he didn't even sentence me to what the DA recommended. And so the DA wanted me to do a year in jail now, have 2 1-to-3-year prison sentences suspended for 5 years of good behavior. The judge ended up giving me another 60 days in jail, suspending 19 months in county and 1 to 3 years in prison for 5 years of good time. So Derek and I have pretty much done the same thing. Derek has left New Hampshire because he has like 365 days or something of suspended sentence hanging over his head. I have about a little over 4 years hanging over my head. And so leaving New Hampshire is a safer option, because though we could be, if we get in trouble away from New Hampshire, we could have our suspended sentence enacted there. It's just less likely that, you know, states are going to share as much information. And though we're both pretty public activists, they'd probably find out. And if I would jaywalk in North Carolina, where I am now, I highly doubt that's going to make it back to New Hampshire. But if in New Hampshire, if you would do something so minor, they're probably going to be sending emails right away like, hey, I got this guy. I mean, I've upset, or at least interacted, if upset isn't the right word, with so many police agencies in New Hampshire that I'm sure some of them would like nothing more than to tie me up on some sort of minor charge and enact that suspended sentence. Because what people should know about suspended sentences, there is no hearing. There is a hearing. There's a meeting. You're not going to it. You're not allowed to speak at it. But, you know, if I would do any sort of interaction with police, the DA who sentenced me would just call up the judge and say, yo, I saw this, go get him, put out a warrant and bring him to jail. And that's that. And so it's a very big power for the state to use. And it's often why they do enact a big suspended sentence on some of these victimless crime issues or with activists, because then on TV, on the news for everybody, when I was sentenced, it's like, oh, he got 60 days. Yeah. So it's not that big of an outrage. We're not putting him in prison for 20 years. But in 6 months from now, if they pick me up for jaywalking, no one would ever really hear about it. I'd just be in jail, you know, and that's it. So if they would have sentenced me to 4 years in prison on the day of my wiretapping, people probably would have went berserk, you know, but now it's like, oh, it's 60 days and whatever. And so they set themselves up to be able to punish you, A, without trial or without much public awareness, but B, also make themselves look good when they actually do sentence to you and they, you know, they seem like they were sympathetic, you know, like, oh, we're only going to take 60 days of his life.
Yeah, and another trick they didn't pull with you guys, I guess, but I've seen this in other cases in other states. They put the person where he has to constantly report back to a representative of the court, and you have to basically get permission to even leave the state. So you're stuck in some – well, in the case that I'm thinking of specifically is a person I know in Missouri. You're stuck right in your hometown where every cop knows everything about you, and every time you drive down – you know, you drive downtown to buy some groceries or whatever, they're looking at you every single time, and you get pulled over 4 or 5 times a month just for them to walk around your car with their dog and pretend like they're whether or not they're going to decide to search you this time or not. And this kind of thing goes on the whole time that this real serious judgment is hanging over your head, and it's just a constant living in fear. In the case I'm thinking of in Missouri, the guy just literally every time he leaves his house, he has this thing hanging over his head that he has to worry about. And every single time that he sees a cop sitting beside a street sign or whatever, these thoughts go through his head. And it's all levels of intimidation that are there when in the very first place, in the case I'm thinking of in Missouri, there was no violence involved in his case either. No, you know, there was no harm done of any kind.
Exactly. I guess that's one thing I should be thankful for. The district attorney, Michael Valentine, said that probation didn't want anything to do with me. I think that's probably because of my stance on filming public officials, and probation officers are just as public officials as anybody else. And so I don't have the probation aspect. Although again, like I was touching on before, in my opinion, the suspended sentence aspect is just as scary, because again, it's pretty much their call. It's anything, you know, you're pretty safe if you don't have any police interactions, but when you're an advocate for police accountability and somebody like myself who films police as many times as possible, you know, they're pretty much setting you up for failure there. And not to be able to have a hearing or not be able to highlight, you know, why I'd be going to jail is scary for a guy like me.
I'm going to go ahead and save this file, and we'll throw another commercial in here. And stick with us. We're going to be back in about either 30 seconds or 60 seconds, according to which commercials are on. And so stick with us. We'll be right back.
Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy, and Amazon has great prices, and in most cases you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of, plus it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give Bad Quaker a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the break. Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast with Ademo Freeman. Ademo, what are you up to these days? What kind of projects are you working on?
Well, I'm just getting my feet, back in the water. And 2012, like I mentioned earlier, was a little rough for me. Bad business decision, bad time in jail. Finally ended these things. But anyways, I still feel on the flip side of that coin, like a lot of stress has been relieved for me. I don't have to, you know, there's a lot of anxiety for myself that comes with battling with the state. You know, they're so unpredictable, you know, even though they're so predictable, like, you know, I know they're going to jail me, but like how long and for what? And, you know, what are they going to do to you in jail? You know, Valley Street is one of the most notorious jails in the New England area. You know, even in my short 92-day stay there, three people died inside that jail. And it's just, you know, jail in general, whether it's the Martha Stewart, you know, Club Med jail or, you know, Cook County, it's never a good place to be locked inside of a room. So, just getting back on the ground here, and I've just reassumed my editing capabilities over at coplock.org, and, you know, Pete and I are starting to work together on, you know, what's next. You know, there's this great foundation. Coplock.org has over 100,000 unique views every month. Like I mentioned earlier, the Facebook page is approaching 40,000 likes. There's at least 60 or more allies or exact coplock.org offshoots that have spurred up across the country. And so now what? And basically, you know, with all the things going on with government, there's this big gun control issue. There's the NDAA. There's still these Patriot Act things. The numerous actions of, you know, officers towards victimless offenders or more or less, you know, control. And so there is no better time than now than to advocate or support police accountability, even if it's not coplock.org. Right now, Pete is talking about testing something that we've thought about for a long time, which is a coplock.org tour. He recently just did a post and video on it. If you head over to coplock.org, it's right there in our main video feed. But he is going to try to test out a little short tour in the Northeast and, you know, go around the coplock chapters, try to, you know, teach them some tactics and provide them with some educational information and really try to solidify what each group can do locally and, you know, get their message out there so that A, they can, you know, recruit and get more people and B, learn and share tactics. And so that's a great thing that I interest folks to check out. Something I'm working on as well and that I believe Pete and I will do together in the near future is coplock.org memberships. And this is a way to not only help take coplock to the next level by funding for, you know, these education materials. You know, we want to make like a trifold folder of like 10 tips to remember when being stopped by the police or what to do when you film the police or so you've been arrested by the police and all this stuff that we want to get out there. And so coplock.org memberships will not only help provide that, but it'll also give the members of coplock.org the sense of security to know that, hey, what we do here at Coplock, what has been done in plenty of my arrest and what we've done for plenty of other people's arrest is this PR, social media, you know, new media push where, you know, we blog about your interactions, we make you videos, we might help you file freedom of information requests. So basically a coplock.org member will donate anywhere from $7 to $50 a month. And through that variance of memberships, they could either they get some level of coplock.org protection. And therefore, you know, not only are they helping to promote police accountability, but they're also buying a little bit of security that, hey, you know, I'm going to have people at my back because when the man comes at you, when an officer arrests you, he has a DA to prosecute you, a judge to hear over this case, and they have all this stuff to overwhelm you and mount against you. Becoming a coplock.org member can help level that playing field as well as, I hope nobody has these police interactions, but if you don't and you're contributing $7 a month to Coplock, you also have peace of mind knowing that we are going to advance the message and cause of police accountability to the fullest.
Yeah, and $7 a month is not really, you know, that's an amount that is very reasonable, and it's not going to break anybody's bank if you just have a, you know, a regular type of a job, or you don't have to be a millionaire or whatever to support it. But also, if a person does have, you know, a little hint to the listeners here, if a person does have some real wealth and would like to help out on this, I'm sure you guys could stand, you know, a more permanent sponsor as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people are free to do what they like with their own funds and stuff like that. I've found that me personally, you know, Pete and I both, you know, not only do we try to be as transparent as possible, especially when we ask for funds for particular reasons, and I believe we've been very successful at that. But something else is like what I feel about coplock.org memberships is that it will gray the area between, hey, give us money, to between the simple give us money ask or the provide a service. So what my goal is here is to say, hey, yes, we are asking for donations, but I'm going to give you something in return. Just know that, you know, the Thin Blue Line has this network. They help and they take care of each other. Now, I really don't want to mimic the Thin Blue Line because they seem to be a little more violent and fraudulent and you know, I just don't really want to mimic that. But coplock.org should build a network of folks who will help and interact with one another. So becoming a member is not only helps us clarify and solidify this network, but again, like I said, sadly, funds are needed, you know, in order to provide these educational materials, you know, the graphic design, the printing, the distribution of you know, I got to sit down and write these things out. And, you know, not only can I do this, but I can network with a group of folks who are willing to, you know, put their money where their mouth is, essentially.
On a sort of a different vein of thought, you've been in this. You've been in this for a long time. You've been active in a variety of different ways in the movement and going all the way back for that I know of for years. At what point in your life did you look around and realize, you know, this system is really messed up, and I think I want to do something about it? At what point did thoughts like that become so prevalent to you that you actually took the step and started doing stuff?
Well, I think I was one of the lucky ones. You know, I didn't grow up in a household that, you know, was heavily political or really aware of the issues. But I've always had a personality of question authority. You know, even in school, I can remember, you know, when I first got to middle school and the bell thing, you know, like, oh, the bell would ring and you go to your next class when you first started switching class. And I remember thinking and telling teachers, students, like, why are we just going to this bell? Why do we just do what everybody says, you know, and stuff like that. But I think it really started to come together when my experience becoming a victim of the war on drugs, when I was 19 years old, I caught a felony for conspiracy to distribute. And I bought into the whole propaganda brainwashing of the war on drugs that, yes, I was a bad person. I was a drug dealer. I was ruining people's lives. And so I bought into it all. I accepted my punishment through my plea deal. I did my community service of talking to students at schools about how how drugs had ruined my life. And to be honest, I had to do 100 hours of community service of talking to children. And about halfway through it, I didn't believe what I was saying. You know, after repeating this over so many times, it started to appeal to me that I really wasn't doing anything wrong to people. I was providing them a service. You know, it wasn't like on TV or like I was holding guns to people's head, like buy my stuff. These were all voluntary interactions with no violence whatsoever. And so when I started to figure that out, I started to get involved, you know, in campaigns and political processes. And I learned how that really wasn't the best use of my time. And politicians had like, you know, I helped a guy get elected locally and then he reversed his position. And then it wasn't until, you know, that was early 2000s. And then around 2005, 2006, I started to become very active online about my opinions. And, you know, at this time, I'm more of a constitutionalist in my mind. And then it was 2008 with the Ron Paul that really started to bring me to an idea of complete liberty. And the final push was when I became a lot more active. And that was through the project of motorhomediaries.com, where I met the co-founder of copblock.org, Pete Ayer, as well as Jason Talley. And they had the project, like I just mentioned, motorhomediaries.com. And I lived in Wisconsin and they were coming by and I ended up jumping on board with them for a month and ended up staying for the duration of the trip for all 7 months and moved to New Hampshire. And Pete and I later did Liberty on Tour and copblock.org. And so it was just like a natural progression. I think I've always been one to question anything, you know, like, you know, but why do the stoplights turn red and da 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 as a little kid to, you know, why should I do this or why should I listen to that as I grew? And then, you know, once the experiences of my life gave me a firsthand experience of the abuses the state can put onto an individual, it was pretty much downhill from there, or however you want to look at it. It was a positive in my opinion.
I remember, I think I found out about Motorhome Diaries maybe within the first two or three weeks of when the guys really took off and started doing it. And it was really fun to keep updated, you know, every time the new video appeared and what the guys were up to and all that. I really enjoyed that back in those days. And then to just drag up old laundry, you guys were headed through Tennessee, wasn't it, when you had a little difficulties with the motorhome?
Well, we were in Mississippi, if you're talking about my first arrest for filming a public official.
let's hit that one.
We had been in Texas like 2 days before that, and we interviewed Ron Paul in his hometown and in the RV when it was like 110 degrees, and Pete did a really great interview with him. If anyone searched Ron Paul and Motorhome Diaries, I'm sure it would pop up. It's one of our more popular videos. But we had a quick pit stop in Louisiana, hung out with some friends like Dan D'Amico from Loyola University, a great guy, professor down there who does a lot with Walter Block and is making a name for himself writing about the nation's prison industrial complex. And so anyways, after a quick stop there, we were heading north to go to Tennessee, and driving through Mississippi, we were pulled over by the Jones County Sheriff's Department, who, in my opinion, thought that Pete and I, who were both shirtless, Pete was driving and I was riding shotgun, and we were both shirtless and we're both tattooed, younger looking dudes. And I believe that the sheriff thought that we were like operating a mobile meth lab or something like that, because they pulled us over for no reason and really only wanted to get into the RV and search it. And so I came out with a video camera. They didn't like that. I refused to shut it off. I was arrested for filming a traffic stop. The sheriffs then deleted the footage, arrested everybody else after they maced Jason Talley because he wouldn't provide ID because he said he didn't have to because he wasn't driving the vehicle, which was absolutely true because he was sleeping when we were pulled over. So anyways, they arrest us all, search the RV, can't find anything. They end up charging me with disorderly conduct, Jason with disorderly conduct, and Pete, who was very cooperative during it, not in the sense of like narking on his friends or doing whatever, but just answering their questions with questions. And even though they were threatening him with like gun charges and all these other things, but ultimately at the end of the day, the only thing they could charge Pete with was possession of a beer in a dry county, a beer that was in our refrigerator and not open. Like I want to make it clear. It wasn't like in the cup holder in the front while he was driving. Pete doesn't even drink beer. First of all, second, it was in the refrigerator closed. So it's like, you know, the dry county aspect is just ridiculous. You know, we didn't ever intended to stop in this county. You stopped us in this county. And so what? And so we had a, I don't know, a 2.5 year ordeal with that. And I ultimately was found guilty in a lower court and then had a hung jury in a higher court. And the district attorney there has still to this day, he has 7 years to decide whether or not to bring charges on there, but he hasn't retried me for that, and he still hasn't returned my money. So I know Pete and Jason got some of their money back, and it was weird. I don't know why Jason got his back, because he just didn't show up to court one day and they just found him guilty. So very weird scenario. But yeah, that was late 2008 is when I started contacting with them, and early 2009 is when I hooked up with them, and that was in like the middle of 2009. And so that was like I think that's when Motorhome Diaries first became popular, was after our interview with Ron Paul and within the same week arrest in Mississippi. So it was like a 1-2 combo.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking about. I don't know why I confused Tennessee with Mississippi, but that was the one I was thinking of. They ransacked the motorhome. I mean, threw everything in the floor. It was bizarre what they did.
In about the 3 years that Pete and I have spent traveling around, I mean, 4 or 5 times, I want to say, the motorhome has been ransacked. I mean, one time, the offending officers violating our home actually hung up like cop lock T-shirts, like from the door corners. Like they opened the doors and they put them over the door. And so I kind of like to laugh at us, but, you know, it's whatever. It is what it is.
And here's a quick little lesson for anybody in the future who's thinking of, you know, doing some kind of protest or doing some type of activism. If you guys had had so much as a joint on you, you know, or if there had been anything that they could have made a big case out of, then you guys would have just been more drug dealing scum that nobody would have cared about. You just, you know, it would have been passed off. But the fact that, you know, the only thing that they got you for was for having closed containers in a dry county. It just, how bizarre was that? You know, people just couldn't sit back and say nothing about it.
Right. I mean, even for me, they didn't even get that much on me. Like I was arrested for contempt of cop. I told a cop no. That's why I was arrested, you know, and they deleted the footage. I mean, these guys were caught red-handed and, you know, abusing their rights, destroying and destruction of property and or evidence. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm fine with, you know, we highlighted it very well, and I'm sure we gave these guys a headache. But to be honest, at the end of the day, they got away with it. You know, the only reason why I have any peace of mind of it in my head is that I hope that through the interactions of us showing that the RV being ransacked, the clear and blatant lies of these officers, that's inspired and or woke somebody else up that has continued on, you know, because in the terms of, you know, making me whole as a victim or getting what I perceive to be justice, I fail miserably at that.
Yeah, well, that's hard to do with, you know, with government. They play these games for a living. That's what they do. So, you know, trying to get actual justice out of them is rare. I guess the old saying is even a broke clock is right once a day or twice a day or whatever. But
I try to reach or be educational for everybody, you know, whether you're a government agent or not. It doesn't really matter to me. There was a time when I first started becoming an activist where my goal was to convince everybody to believe what I believed. And today that just isn't the case. I'm here as a journalist, as an educational source to point out what I believe. I am by no means neutral, or this is not the no spin zone. My zone is spinning like a mofo. I have very strict views of what I think society, government, or justice would be, and I will promote those ideas to the fullest. And if you want to, you know, look me up and say, hey, you're wrong, or make a video or do whatever, hey man, you're free to do that too. But right now, like, all I care about is providing honest information to people, you know, show the system for what it is and let them make their own choices. You know, if you want to have the government we have now, then great. And can I opt out? Are you fine with forcing me? You know, like, I don't care if people go buy a bunch of property and have a Congress and a president and they want to do all this crazy stuff with like collectivism, but don't force me into it and don't send men with guns to my house. You know, that's pretty much my message these days.
Well, we've got about a minute or two. Is there anything else that you want to mention or any websites you want to promote before we hang it up for today?
I just want to say thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you taking the time. It was great to finally get to talk with you, and I hope we get to do so in person maybe sometime in the near future, like Porkfest. And to those listening, check out copluck.org. There's the resource page, the groups, the about. Those are all good clicks. But if you're looking at current content, please check out Pete's video. Let's see how this little bit of a tour works out. Let's try to get some educational information into the hands of other cop lockers across the country. And stay tuned for more. You know, the memberships, the building of this network is all in progress. And, you know, we got a great foundation. And I think 2013 is not only going to be a big year to be awake and aware and active, but it'll also be a year of great success for freedom, liberty, you know, and the message of police accountability.
Ademo, thanks again for coming on the show with me. And folks, thank you for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much, folks.